and welcome to the programme. On today's show, a prehistoric plant which was very much a dinosaur delicacy has produced both male and female cones in the UK for the first time in 60 million years. Botanists are linking the return of the cycad on the Isle of Wight to climate change. And another wonder plant which can capture carbon from the atmosphere faster than any tropical forest. Underwater meadows of seagrass are set to be restored to Welsh waters this winter.
Seagrass, the blades of grass, absorb the carbon dioxide from the water and then they store this into the seagrass roots but also the seabed sediments. So it's not actually just stored in the plant itself, it's actually going into the seabed. So this is a really different way of actually capturing carbon and it can be really fast, about 35 times faster than the rate of a tropical forest. So it's a really important means of capturing large volumes of carbon.
And plants and power. Botanical imperialism, how plants played a pivotal role in the rise and fall of empires. It's the intriguing theme of guided walks currently taking place at the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. Derek Mooney is a little under the weather at the moment, so it's me, Michael Cumin, who'll be with you for the next hour, surrounded by the wonderful team, the Mooney Goes Wild team of Aine Lowna and Dr. Richard Collins, along with Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. Now, I have to confess, I do have a keen interest in nature and wildlife, and weirdly enough, spiders in particular, and I've loads of questions to ask the panel today, so I'm going to actually pull a little bit of rank here, including one that I'm now looking, a creature I'm looking at on my phone at the moment. Aine, this creature arrived into the house through the back door, and I'm curious to know what is it. We'll put the picture up on the website as well so the listeners can see it.
Well, I'll give you a clue. It has 8 legs. So, and it's the time of year for them. It's a spider. It's a fine big spider. This is a very good picture of it, I have to say. It's a male spider because it has a smaller abdomen and long palps. And, of course, at this time of the year, these spiders are on the pull. He's out looking for
his girlfriend.
Yes, indeed. Now, this is quite a large spider. It's the big house spider. We call it the bath spider
because
it's just a Latin name for it. And he came into your house looking for the missus. What did you do with him?
No, I very gently put a glass over him, put a piece of card underneath, and he now lives, hopefully, courting again in the garden shed.
Well, you should be sorry for the poor old spider.
Really?
Because spiders are cannibals.
Oh.
So when this fella's going looking for the missus, he's really taking his life in his hand. You ever see a spider's web? There's only ever one spider in it.
Right.
So he has to go looking for your woman and try and mate with her, and it's taking his life in his hand. So he has to prepare himself. So first of all, if you're going courting, you bring a present. So a spider brings a fly all wrapped up like the box of chocolates.
Lovely.
And of course then he wants to do the business.
Mm-hmm.
As gingerly as possible. So he transfers his sperm to the top of his palps. The palps are the horns sticking out the top of his head.
Like little hands at the front, yeah.
Well, the antennae, if you like. They're much longer in the male than the female, which is kind of handy if this is what you're using them for. So when he's going on the pull, he has the box of chocolates in one hand, the antennae mounted on the other, and off he goes. And of course, she rushes out to gobble him up, and he gives her the wrapped up fly. And then she's so busy wrapping up the fly, unwrapping it and liking it and eating it that she doesn't notice what he's doing.
There's a chance he can leg it. He can get
away. So in and out and gone. Now, mind you, if she doesn't like the flavour or if he lingers too long in the love department, she's the adrenaline rush must be mighty all the same.
So we should welcome them.
I mean, they're great spiders, do no harm to anybody. I'm glad you put it out. He's probably back in again, but as long as you don't see him, it doesn't matter.
We do have another one that lives under the couch. Occasionally you'll just see this thing in the corner of your eye lashing out. But no, I welcome them around the place.
I mean, you couldn't prefer flies, could you?
Definitely not. Well, you know what? We should really, I suppose, move on to some serious matters to get things underway.
This is serious.
No, well, as in, curtains one thing, but actually, to be fair, from a distance, it's been described as a tornado, a grey tower shooting out of the forest canopy, reaching thousands of metres into the skies. Up close, it's a raging inferno, ferociously destroying stretches of the world's greatest tropical rainforest, the Amazon, affectionately known as the lungs of the earth. Well, over the past 2 months, wildfires have surged in number, marking an 83% increase over the same period last year, the highest single record since they began in 2013. Well, now, most of the fires are in the Amazon basin, home to about 3 million species of plants and animals and 1 million indigenous people. Fires in the Amazon sometimes occur naturally, ignited by heat from the sun or lightning strikes. However, the majority of fires are started by humans, either deliberately or by accident.
firefighters, no match for flames this ferocious and this intense.
That curtain of fire igniting palm trees here on the Bolivian-Brazilian border, fueled by wind, the flames leaping across the dry brush.
It's shocking how fast we've seen this fire march. It's moved about 200 yards in the past 5 minutes alone, fueled by this wind. We're going to try to get moving a little bit faster to get out of its way. Keep going!
Well, joining us on the line to discuss the full environmental consequences of the Amazon blaze is John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University and climatologist. John, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you, Michael.
You've actually been to the Amazon.
Yes, I was there a few years ago, and I have to say it was one of the most uncomfortable places I've ever visited. The humidity at 100%, the temperature at 33 degrees, you constantly felt your body was under pressure there, and it really was a place that you had to really acclimatise to be comfortable in. It's a very unique habitat, of course, and I was very pleased to be able to visit it, the Peruvian side of it, a few years ago. But it's an exceptional area because the Amazon is really located where the two hemispheres circulations of the world converge, and we get the two trade winds from the northeast and the southeast blowing moisture from Africa across the Atlantic into the Amazon basin. And once it gets there, it's almost a self-sustaining hydrological engine because most of the rain that you get in the Amazon is simply being recycled from the transpiration of that great forest canopy. So it's a very unique ecosystem. And of course, as well as the rainfall, which is very copious, it's about 2 meters a year, as well as the rainfall, those trade winds bring in a lot of African dust, a lot of Saharan dust in particular, which actually makes good all of the losses of phosphate, in particular of sediment, that the Amazon itself drains out of the system in the course of the year. So it's a kind of self-sustaining, self-perpetuating, but very fragile ecosystem in the end of the day, which once we start disrupting it, then the consequences can be quite serious down the road. So that's what, as climatologists, we're worried about, is the tipping points that might exist if we go too far with the fire regime that's now beginning to become established.
Now, burning of the forest isn't a new phenomenon since, I suppose, man has been around in the Amazon. They have done that to clear. But what's this tipping point that we're looking at?
Well, the worry is that when you take the forest cover away, you take that moisture cloud away as well, you replace a dark surface, the forest floor, only about 2% of sunlight gets to the forest floor in the Amazon, and you take that forest cover away and you transfer it to a shiny surface, a light-coloured surface rather than a dark moisture surface. And this, in fact, warms up even more the surface that created and tends to produce savanna grassland rather than forest down the road. And so you get to the point where we've lost about 20% so far of the Amazon. Once we get to a certain level, that kind of heating effect, that local feedback effect, the risk is it takes over. And deforestation is just one of the threats to perhaps induce that kind of tipping point to be more real. There's also, of course, the problem of ENSO and the problem of El Nino, which again creates dry periods in parts of the Amazon basin. And as the globe warms up, those ENSO events, those drought events, are naturally occurring more frequently in the Amazon basin. And they are the two twin threats, I suppose, that models are really worried about in terms of producing an increase of 2 to 3 degrees centigrade by 2050, reducing the rainfall. And the risk is that, you know, if this goes on, we could have 30 to 60% of Amazonia in grassland rather than in forest. And that would be really very fatal for the global climate in terms of our efforts to tackle climate change, but also a transformation which we wouldn't really want within that great carbon store of the Amazon itself, because it's so important for our carbon. It stores about a decade's worth of our anthropogenic emissions of carbon, and to transfer that to a carbon source rather than a carbon sink would undo any efforts we might have to try and tackle global climate change over the next few decades.
So any argument, John, that just by replacing the forest with further vegetation once it's been burnt off, etc., you're losing intrinsically the plants that keep it all working?
You are indeed. And the regeneration, and your other experts in the studio there will be much better at this than me, but the regeneration of that climax vegetation of rainforest, and it's about half the world's rainforest, actually, that the regeneration is never complete for perhaps a century or so. So it's a very, although some trees may regrow, you're looking at really a very imperfect solution to the problem. You're looking at something which never can replicate the diversity, the stable system that we have in terms of nutrients and carbon store and carbon circulation that we have at the moment. So it's not possible to recover in the short term or even the medium term the asset that is the Amazon should we go beyond that tipping point, unfortunately.
Of course, the thing is that they're burning the forests in order to grow crops for cattle and grass. But much of the nutrients are actually in the trees, and it's circulated. The soils are actually quite poor, and if you take away your forest cover and you don't have your trees breaking down and the nutrients going back into the soil, within 2 or 3 years, all that nutrient, particularly if you're harvesting it and taking it away, you're going to end up with soils that are completely barren. So the thing is actually ecologically totally unsound, is it not, Matthew?
Yes, it is. But you know, one of the sort of cynicisms of our comfortable Western world is we already committed the greatest crimes against carbon dioxide production and destruction of woodlands and forests. And what Brazil faces today is the economic problem of how do they earn money from their landscape. And dealing with a forest 65 times the size of Ireland, they have discovered that soybean, cattle, they have a huge market in China. Soybean alone, I think, is worth $26 billion a year to them. And the G7 sat down and lectured Brazil about offering them $30 million to deal with this issue of fires. Essentially, there is an economic driver, probably driven by a trade war that's currently underway against China. And this has led to an escalation in agricultural footprint developing in the Brazilian rainforest. So it is a tragedy that we need to actually wake up and address ourselves rather than pointing fingers of blame at others.
Mm. I was wondering about the soil. The ultimate terminus of this is you remove the trees, you bring in cattle. And then after a while, you change to growing soybeans. And after that, the land gets depleted. And if you look at history, for instance, the Romans destroyed the soil of Italy 2,000 years ago, one of the factors which led to their decline. And if you go to China, the Yellow River is yellow because of the silt being washed away as a result of exploitation of the soil, of the land.
And you have the dust bowls in the city as well.
Flying over the Amazon, I was fortunate enough to fly over it in a small plane, well, a relatively small plane, with the Bolivian Air Force many years ago. And we were low down, and it is an extraordinary experience to see this green sward, this mat stretching to infinity. But it is, there are rivers through it, like veins meandering, and they're all brown, like the Yellow River is. So as Mark Twain said, the land that destroys its soil destroys itself. Mm. Now, if you are going to replace large sections of the Amazon, you're going to wash the value of the place into the rivers and ultimately into the sea. So now, of course, there's terrible problems here. Who owns the Amazon? Who owns anything? You know, Proudhon, the French philosopher, said all property is theft. Yeah. Is the Amazon the property of the settlers, the Portuguese settlers' descendants that arrived there a few centuries ago? Or is it more the property of the people who live there, the very small number of people who live there? There are huge questions here.
Matthew, I want to bring back a point that you mentioned earlier on, about just in relation to the idea, have we lost the moral high ground if we're going to start lecturing, you know, the Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, to say, you know, fix this problem? He has, in fact, turned around and told us to mind our own business.
And I think when you just look at the economics of it, you can understand why he did that. What we should do is say, yes, we in the West, by which I mean really Europe and North America, have contributed more than half of the total carbon gain to the atmosphere. So we are very responsible for it. We have built our civilization, our development, by exploiting resources. And what we now need to share with these people is precisely how we can reduce their carbon footprint as quickly as possible. Because by per capita measurements, the Europeans and the North Americans are far more responsible than the hundreds of millions of people living in Brazil and China who individually have quite small carbon footprints.
And in the sense that offering that country 30 million euros for a problem of this nature is rather insulting in many ways. I mean, it's a rather pathetic amount. I mean, we were supposed to build up a green climate fund to aid countries to make a sustainable transition of 100 billion a year. And countries in the developed world, which, as you rightly say, have a historic responsibility, have not simply squared up to this and have not simply contributed sufficient money to make this a reality. So there is an ethical issue, there's an issue of climate justice, and there is certainly an issue, as you say, of looking after this very vulnerable habitat, because the soil, as Aina rightly points out, although we mentioned a lot of those soil problems in mid-latitude countries, in a very warm tropical country like Brazil, the microbial decay cycle is actually accentuated. So microbes break down organic matter at the surface once it's exposed much more quickly than even in China or even in the Dust Bowl of America. So it's more vulnerable if we make the mistake of continuing deforestation than many of those other areas. And we pay the price, as you say, down the road in terms of losing a carbon store and actually contributing to the deforestation by burning it and adding to our CO2 in the atmosphere. So when people talk about having 10 years left to avoid a probability of 50% of reaching that 1.5 degree threshold, well, what happens in the Amazon will actually telescope that down to smaller time periods. And that's something of concern, not just for Brazil, but of course it's a great concern for the global community as a whole. So it is a global asset, and we have global responsibility. And to be fair to the Brazilians, they have tried in the past. I mean, they were quite successful. Between about 2004 and 2012, they actually reduced deforestation by 80% in the Amazon Basin. And that's a great achievement, given the kind of economic drivers that you've mentioned there in that relatively poor country. So it can be done, but it needs the support of the international community, and it needs us to face up to our responsibilities. And Ireland has not been prominent either in its contribution to the Green Climate Fund over the years. So we have to stand up and be counted here as well.
John, you said there was an agreement for 100 billion. I mean, is that Amshakachi, is that gone? I mean, or was that at the Paris Accord? When did that agreement happen? And is it gone?
That agreement was way back about 10 years ago. And the Green Climate Fund is centered in Seoul in Korea. And some countries have been very generous towards it. I think Denmark has given the equivalent of about $50 per capita to that fund. Ireland has given the equivalent of 50 cents per capita. So it's not something you hear much about in Ireland, but we do have to, I think, stand up and be counted on this one, because in terms of our per capita income, our per capita GDP, we should be contributing a lot more than we are to that particular fund. It's something which hasn't taken off, and of course there are some countries even within Europe which haven't contributed significantly at all. So it is, I think, essential that as part of the Paris Agreement down the road, this particular fund to help countries make a sustainable transition, not to make the mistakes that we've made in the developed world. And perhaps it's also conscious money that we should recognise we have that responsibility to support them in so doing.
And one of the points there, John, is it's tiny what we should be doing. If you think of the total economy here in Ireland, our tax take,
take is approaching 70 billion a year. 1% of that, 700 million, if Ireland was to contribute half a billion a year, that's 1% of our economy. And we owe it to the children of Ireland that their future will have these forests, this biodiversity of the globe is protected. And in terms of insurance payments of 1%, that is tiny. It is tiny.
I don't want to cloud the story, but there's also fires burning in Indonesia and Bolivia at the moment. Is the Amazon one more important?
I think the Amazon's become a whipping boy for the moment, which it is. And I think, you know, part of what we're talking about is it's a global problem. It's a global problem driven by the remoteness that we don't understand when we go to a shop, what has come from things like palm oil, from soybean oil. We have overlooked the impact of our purchasing of what it does to the world. And therefore, every one of us is able to actually make a change. The one thing one should never take away from listening to a conversation like this is a pessimism of the world is doomed and we're doomed with it. There are ways to protect it. And 7 billion people changing their habits will completely and radically alter the way we exploit this earth.
The Amazon as well, though, I think it is slightly different from Indonesia and from the other tropical forests in that it is by far the most biodiverse, rich part of the world. I mean, we have about 1 in 10 of the world's species located there, with about 100 new species being discovered each year in Amazonia. And of course, there is this feeling that, you know, sometimes we may be rendering extinct a species which may be of a great intrinsic value, especially medically for us down the road. And that's the kind of fear that we have in the Amazon, that we're burning our bridges literally in terms of future options for things that may be very useful in curing diseases that we have at present. It is just, 20% of the world's fish species, something the same in terms of the world's insects. These are things that, you know, we're wiping out quickly there. And even in Indonesia, where the drivers are slightly different, where per capita income is slightly higher, I think we recognise the treasure trove that is the Amazon in terms of species diversity.
John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University and Climatologist, thank you for joining us on Mooney Goes Wild. Well, now, the greatest service which can be rendered to any country is to add a useful plant to its culture. So said Thomas Jefferson. And it's easy to see what the American president meant when we look at the sugar in our tea, or the tea itself, or perhaps you prefer coffee, or if we look at how the world has been shaped through the trading of cotton, tobacco, potatoes, vanilla, opium, rubber, and an array of other plants. Botanical Imperialism is the intriguing title of a new series of guided walks in the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, taking place on Saturdays over the coming weeks. Given by guide Charlotte Salter Townsend, these tours of the garden examine how plants helped build empires, developed slavery, and shaped international trading conventions and routes which continue today. Our John Bell O'Reilly met Charlotte at the gardens in Glasnevin.
Also in the seeds, there is a poison called ricin, and it's one of the most deadly poisons in the world.
Yes, I'm here at the Botanic Gardens, home to some 16,000 plants from all over the world. I'm in the fabulous five-story tall curvilinear greenhouse, so-called as the glass in the roof section curves inwards. Today it houses the Plants for People section with many exotic and familiar varieties, including papyrus, cotton, grapevine, olive, and many others. I'm here with Charlotte Salter Townsend. Charlotte, the gardens here were set up for scientific study to enhance our knowledge of botany. And weren't plants also sent here with empire building in mind, what you call botanical imperialism?
So, the gardens at Kew and many others in the British Empire were established with very much an economic incentive and the desire to increase the power of the British Empire. And a lot of their power came through plants, through the trade of plants. And the idea was to further knowledge, and knowledge leads to power, so that the British Empire could expand their interests and gain a greater income through trading of plants that we'll explore on this tour.
Here we have a shrub with green leaves and little white flowers. It's a tea plant. The precise origins of this plant are unknown, but it's undoubtedly native to China. The British wanted to break the Chinese monopoly on tea in the 1800s. How did they go about that?
So they decided that the best way to do it would be to send over a plant hunter to transport plants and knowledge of how to grow the plants to their plantations in India. So they had control of India, and they'd found suitable grounds there to grow tea. They found wild tea plants they knew they would grow there. And so Robert Fortune, a Scottish plant hunter, was sent over. He ultimately managed to smuggle 20,000 tea plants and bring with him tea workers to set up plantations in Assam, Darjeeling, and modern-day Sri Lanka. And these people then passed on the knowledge, and the knowledge led to these plantations that really ended up supplying almost all of the tea to Britain within a few years.
So our next plant is sugarcane, and I remember this plant from being in India in the 1990s, where you would see street vendors butchering its cane with machetes before pushing it through a press, out of which came this wonderfully refreshing raw sugarcane juice. But am I right in thinking, Charlotte, that the Dutch swapped New York, which of course formerly was New Amsterdam, with the British for a slice of the sugar trade?
Yes, they did. This happened in the 1660s following one of the Dutch Anglo Wars, which were about colonialism and trade. And so they swapped what was New Amsterdam and became New York for Suriname and for Run Island, one of the Spice Islands. And one of the most important commodities was sugarcane in Suriname.
Where next?
So we're going to head over to the Great Palm House, which houses Ireland's only tropical rainforest.
Let's go visit.
Lovely.
And obviously there were lots of plants from all over the world, and some of which we are now so familiar with that we maybe no longer think of them as being exotic. You know, one example of that might be the potato, which is also here. But the Spanish didn't realise the great wealth and power that they had found when they stumbled across the humble potato in the 1500s. And why did the potato become so popular here, Charlotte?
Well, it took a while for people to take to this new crop, but they soon discovered that as little as 1 acre could feed 10 people for 1 year. So you have a high yield. You need less equipment to grow the potato and cultivate it, and indeed to cook it as well. You just need a pot to boil the potatoes in.
And a lot of research went on here in the Botanic Gardens into potato blight in the 1840s. Did that research have any bearing on events?
Ultimately, the cure was not found for the blight, but a better understanding of it was reached. So David Moore was a great botanist, and he was the curator of the gardens. He was asked to investigate the cause of the blight, and he helped people realise that it was a fungal disease. And so he tried to find a treatment, didn't manage to, but he established some important scientific networks and understanding of fungal diseases.
Fantastic. Okay, let's go on inside. It's a little bit warmer here in the Great Palm House, somewhere in the mid-20s. And there are recognisable plants here too, including bamboo, a variety of palm plants. There's a pineapple plant and a spindly little tree, which is a coffee plant. Most of us enjoy coffee, but what do we know of its origins, Charlotte? Why did Arab nations scald coffee beans, for example? And how did Europeans get around that?
So we trace it back to modern-day Ethiopia, that part of Africa, and initially it was traded into Europe from Arab countries. They scalded the beans to make sure they weren't viable so that other countries, other powers, couldn't start to grow plantations of them.
So that they wouldn't germinate.
So they wouldn't germinate, exactly. The Dutch finally obtained viable beans from Mocha in Yemen, and I can tell you that from a plant that was grown in Amsterdam in 1706, most of the coffee in South America traces its ancestry.
So does that mean that much of the coffee that we drink today comes from that one individual plant?
Yes, but of course over generations they bred the plants, and each seed has different DNA, so they're able to produce different varieties.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlotte.
Thank you so much, John. It was great showing you around.
And a reminder, you can join Charlotte Salter Townsend on her tours on the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, at 3 o'clock, and on Saturday, the 21st and 28th of September, both at 2:30. And there are more tours planned again for February. See botanicgardens.ie for more details.
one of the extraordinary things about tropical crops is they only work well in a different country to their country of origin, because you can imagine coffee has evolved in Ethiopia, and that's where all its pests are, the beetles that love to eat it, the fungi that like to attack it. So if you take it to Central America or Southeast Asia, it flourishes because it's away from all its pests and diseases. So, of course, rubber has succeeded enormously in Malaysia, India, but in Brazil itself, it's a very difficult crop to grow. And likewise, coffee is supporting now whole industries, whole countries in Central America.
Only, of course, we did actually import potato blight from America. Actually, we took it back from the country of origin on a Goanna ship, I believe, and that's what came into Europe to Brussels way back in 1845. So we took the pest from the country where it was, and we didn't have to, but we did.
And the great cruelty of that is this realisation that we still seem to find a surprise, is a lack of biodiversity is often the Achilles heel of these crops. So the potatoes being grown in Ireland were down to just a couple of cultivars from a tiny original genetic basis. And we now need to go back to the Andes to...
properly, with our chequebooks rather than stealing
it. Exactly, yeah. To get the wild potatoes there, and that boosts up the genetic diversity of our crops, which is so important for our future, that our forestry plants, our agricultural crops need to be as diverse as possible. And yet, we still don't seem to have learnt those lessons.
Imperialism is a good term, actually. Catherine Braganza was a Portuguese princess, and the Portuguese were the first, I gather, to bring tea in and drink tea. And she married the Merry Monarch, Charles II, who had a mistress for every one of the articles in the Protestant Declaration. But anyway, that aside, and of course, eventually that was...
No wonder she had nothing to do when he drank tea. No,
indeed, but as a result of Catherine, tea drinking caught on. So this became in great demand. But what percentage of our crops are actually artificial entities we bring in? Practically everything we eat turns out to have been brought from somewhere and modified by selective breeding to form something unrecognisable to what it was, where it came from. How can you put a kind of figure on this? Is there anything natural, whatever that word means, anymore?
You're talking about the paleo diet.
You are partly, but you're also talking about a tiny number of plants that we subsist on as the human race. So we've got things like maize, wheat, barley, rice, these huge crops absolutely dominate the globe. And if you think wheat alone, 600 million tonnes is grown each year. Now, to put that in perspective, the human race, if you put 7 billion people on the weighing scale, that's 400 million tonnes. So 1.5 times the weight of the human race is grown in wheat every year. And wheat is not a wild species of plant. It was probably first discovered by a woman on the shores of the Black Sea who was waiting maybe for all the men in the village to catch a mammoth, and she needed to feed her children. So she harvested some wild grass seeds, which happened to be an extraordinary hybrid between two species of wild grass. And our modern wheat is actually a triple hybrid. It comes from three original wild species. So it was harvested one day, 8,000-9,000 years ago, and it has become the staple crop of a huge proportion of the globe.
Yeah, because we were hunter-gatherers before then. We were Mesolithic peoples, and we went around gathering food as it grew in the wild. So in Ireland, we were in a deciduous woodland, feeding on nuts, feeding on fish that were in the rivers. That was the way it was. And it was only with the advent of farming, when you could actually make your own food in the same place, that the population of the world began to rocket. Before that, it wasn't. I mean, it was the Neolithic peoples and the farming that set the world on the... And it's only for 10,000 years that's been happening. And for all the other millions of years, we lived off the land.
And the luxury of then being able to sit down and chat and talk and make up extraordinary stories and ideas. So culture is born once you have the time to talk to one another, because otherwise you're so busy catching or growing food. Yeah, so it was a revolutionary thing. And if you think human beings have been around on the earth for at least 250,000 years, and it is only in the last 9,000-10,000 years that agriculture on a massive scale has enabled us to have that luxury of time. But it, of course, has ended up with us now ravaging the poor planet.
Well, look, back in the Jurassic period, dinosaurs loved to dine on them. And during his lifetime, David Bowie enjoyed coveting them. Cycads have a cult following, some costing collectors tens of thousands of euros. These plants are incredibly rare, with 95% of the 300-plus species currently threatened with extinction, despite international laws governing their harvest or trade. So it's very exciting news that this prehistoric tropical plant has produced male and female cones in this part of the world for the very first time in 60 million years. Two cycads have in fact produced cones of both sexes on the cliffs of a botanic garden in the Isle of Wight. The island is warmer than most parts of the UK, only the Isles of Scilly have a higher temperature, and botanists are saying that this is another clear indication of climate change. Chris Kidd is curator at Ventnor Botanic Gardens, and I spoke with him earlier and asked him about these two plants and how they came to the attention of everyone there.
We've been growing unusual plants that are subtropical, the plants you wouldn't normally be able to grow out of doors in the UK at Ventnor for 30 years, and we've tried to push the boundaries of things that you wouldn't expect to be able to grow, and cycads are a great example of that. They come from a part of the world, very few places left. These particular plants are from Japan, and they're the sort of things which would normally be grown as house plants. So we put them outside speculatively about 18 years ago, and this year they've produced cones for the first time out of doors. We have a male plant and a female plant, and this is the first time that this will have happened in this particular part of the Isle of Wight since cycads grew here 60 million years ago, which we know from fossils which have fallen out of a cliff nearby to where the garden now is.
So these are quite specific in terms of the conditions that they require before they start going to produce the cones. And is that your evidence that there's climate change affecting the particular area you're in at the moment?
Indeed. Just to be able to grow these plants out of doors is quite an achievement, because the temperatures they need to be in excess of warmth above zero, ideally above 4 or 5 degrees Celsius for long periods of time throughout the whole year. In order to produce new rosettes of leaves and produce cones, the temperatures during the summer months have to be in excess of 21 degrees for a prolonged period, about 3 months. And historically, these sort of conditions haven't been available anywhere in the UK. But where climate is changing, Ventnor Botanic Garden, sitting in a very mild microclimate, we've had the conditions now been upon us, and this has happened.
And just to appreciate how old a species they are, these would have been the staple diet for some dinosaurs.
Yes, when the dinosaurs were on the planet, it was before flowering plants had come onto the scene. And the dominant flora that would have been seen across the whole world is much more like the plants that you would see or refer to now as conifers or ferns. And cycads were amongst that group. They were non-flowering plants. And they would have been a dominant plant on the whole of the planet, and they would have indeed been feasted on by the herbivorous dinosaurs.
Chris Kidd, thank you for joining us from the Isle of Wight.
Pleasure.
That was Chris Kidd, curator at Ventnor Botanic Gardens in the Isle of Wight, speaking to me earlier. Well, just how significant is this development in the botanic world? Matthew Jebb is director of the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. You too must have mixed emotions on hearing this particular bit of news, Matthew.
Exactly. It's another example of how climate change is ever present now. I know that in Dublin we have got cycads growing out of doors on Hoth Head, so they are mild enough out there to survive. In the Botanic Gardens itself in Glasnevin, we have occasional winter frost, so we haven't actually been brave enough to risk any of our plants out of doors. And as was explained there, that cycad takes a long time. We have some cycads that are 100 years old, and they have still to produce their first cone. And of course, as male and female plants, the timing of this has to be exact. They both have to appear at the same time. And then the pollinator, which in the wild would be a little beetle, usually a weevil, with an extraordinary huge long rostrum, this extraordinary long mouth part, and they would transfer the pollen from one cone to the next. And the process is that if a weevil wants to bump into a weevil of the opposite sex, the best place to find such a companion is in a cycad cone. It's a nice warm place. Cycad cones actually warm up. They are dark. They're attractive in that you can avoid predators. So you can meet up with other beetles there. And this is the process of whereby these beetles became attached in a relationship with the cycad plants. And today, some cycad species are down to no more than a few dozen individuals. And it appears that the beetles have long since gone extinct. So once a species has shrunk to a point where there's no available habitat for these beetles to live, they have disappeared. And therefore, these plants are now bereft of a pollinator.
So this is not so new as all of that. It's just a coincidence that this time the two have got their cones at the same time. You get a male an odd time, you get a female an odd time, but now, you know, now the two have happened at the same time. Is this just a coincidence, or is it actually a malevolent indicator of climate change getting worse by the minute?
It's just that. It is the warming. In the botanic gardens in Glasnevin, we have plants we have been monitoring for close on 45 years now to mark the dates on which the flowers appear, the leaves appear, and when the leaves drop off. And observations in nature as well have revealed that the sort of springtime flowering and leaf production has come forward by many weeks.
But this is ordinary plants, this is not cycads.
It is exactly all plants. So what one can see is the rate of climatic change. And people always talk about degrees centigrade, but actually it's much better to think of it in terms of plants as the zonation. Because if you are growing plants down in Wexford, it's much drier and warmer than, say, Donegal. The spring arrives earlier on the south coast of Ireland. And what is happening, it is as though Ireland is moving southward. So climate change is moving at the rate of 4 kilometres a year, which translates into 12 metres a day is how much the climate envelopes are shifting in this part of Europe.
As slow as a snail.
It's faster. If you were a slug trying to avoid climate change, you've got to move at 12 metres a day in the right direction, which is heading north into the cooler and quieter historic times, if you like.
It just occurs to me, Matthew, that we haven't quite described the plant fully for people listening on radio as against looking at it online or otherwise. And it's often confused with a palm or a fern, but it isn't.
Yes, so a cycad is a seed plant, but it's a conifer, so it doesn't have flowers. It produces a massive cone at its head, but it's a single trunked plant. And it has a lovely big whorl of leaves, a huge set of feather-like leaves at its apex. And there is one plant that we have in the National Botanic Gardens that is a male. He's a male. He's only been found once in history. So he was the sole surviving representative of his species. There is no female. So technically, that wretched plant is extinct, unless a female was to be discovered, and it's looking very, very unlikely now. This South African plant, represented by a single male line, has no companion with which to make baby cycads.
I'm seeing a pattern here on the programme so far of all of these lonely heart plants
all be ruins
and poor spiders carrying gifts as well.
Presumably you've sent shoots of this off to other botanicals. It's like the Mullamy pine kind of thing, you know. It's doing fine, but in a restricted fashion. Is that the situation?
You're right. Ours is one of about 30 around the world. So these have been produced by little pups from the base of the original daddy plant. But it is our duty, if you like, to say, well, what could we do to bring this back? And one project that's being tried is to hybridise it with the closest living relative, a different species. And we already have babies growing up, which are half of this father plant, if you like, and a surrogate mother. So they're hybrids. They're only 50% of the original plant, which is known as Encephalatus woodii. We can call it Woods cycad. And these hybrid Woods cycads will be back-crossed with dad in the future. Mm-hmm. They'll be back crossed with granddad, with great granddad. And in about 400, 500, 600 years, we will have offspring that will be, if you like, nearly 90% of Encephalitis woodii, but they will be female. So in a way, we can piggyback these plants with a closest relative. And one day in the future, we will have a viable plant that could perhaps say that we've brought it back from the edge of extinction.
When do you call, you botanists call it the wooden brain? I think Encephalitis would be a woody.
Yes, it's because it produces a big cone. It looks like a huge head on the top of a narrow, upright body. So that's where the name originally comes from, but they were exploited by people as a source of starch, so you can chop out the interior of these plants.
I did mention at the beginning that there were some famous collectors, David Bowie and a couple of other movie stars, Brad Pitt is another one as well. What's the attraction for collectors? And $50,000 for one plant I saw as well online when I was having a quick look at them.
The great irony is, you know, the rarer something is, the higher the price on its head, and the great auk is a wonderful example of how human greed can lead to the extinction of a species. The great auk, you know, one of our big, it was the penguin of the north, if you like, an auk that grew to a huge size such that it couldn't even fly. But the last eggs of that species were hunted by museums because they wanted one for their collection. A great tragedy, and it's happening today with plant species all around the world, that a high price is put on its head and people hunt it down. Recently, I've been working on a group of plants, which are the pitcher plants of Southeast Asia, and the trade in that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And looking at the price on the individual species, the rarer the species is, the higher the price. It's a very, very simple measure of what our foolhardiness is leading to.
Tulips in Amsterdam come to mind.
Yes.
The black tulip.
Well, the fires that have engulfed the Amazon rainforest, the largest land-based carbon sink on the planet, remind us of the fragility of our ecosystem and the importance of looking to other carbon stores. The ocean's role in halting climate change has never been more clear. But did you know that a simple submarine plant captures carbon at up to 35 times faster than tropical rainforests? The plant is seagrass, but it too has suffered a steep decline in recent decades caused by pollution, runoff from the land, coastal development and damage from boat propellers, with up to 92% of seagrass having disappeared in UK waters alone in the last century. Well, one project is looking to reverse this decline. Sky Ocean Rescue, the World Wildlife Fund and Swansea University are together launching the biggest seagrass restoration project ever undertaken in the UK. Well, Dr. Jenny Oates is UKC Programme Manager with the WWF and is in Cardiff. Jenny, welcome to the programme.
Hello there.
What can you tell me about seagrass?
Yes, well, seagrass is really a wonder plant. So it's a flowering plant that grows under the sea, forming underwater meadows, which are absolutely full of life. So seagrass provides a habitat for animals like seahorses and pipefish, which are a kind of fish that's closely related to seahorses, and they hide in the fronds of the seagrass with their long bodies. It's also a home for animals like crabs and baby cuttlefish. And importantly, seagrass provides a nursery habitat for young fish that we like to eat, so species like plaice and cod. And seagrass can actually provide a home for 40 times more animals than bare sand alone. So it's really important as a place for marine wildlife to live. But also, really importantly, seagrass is really great at capturing carbon. So it can capture carbon at a rate 35 times faster than tropical forests and store it in its roots and sediments. So this is another reason why seagrass is really an amazing plant.
And what distinguishes it from seaweed?
So it's a different kind of plant from seaweed. It's a flowering plant and it has bright green leaves, and the seagrass seeds grow in these in the long blades of the grass, and these are the parts that we can harvest in order to be able to collect them.
Why has it declined so much, Jenny?
Well, seagrass is under threat from issues like poor water quality, so runoff from the land, from human pollution and agricultural runoff. It also gets damaged by boats from their propellers and anchoring, and some kinds of fishing can cause damage to seagrass too. And also in the past, coastal development has been a big issue, clearing areas of seagrass beds. So it's actually declined by up to 92% in the UK in the last century. And globally, we lose an area the same size as two football pitches every hour. So really, governments haven't been doing enough to protect the seagrass that we have.
Of course, it grows in very shallow water because it needs light, and light, the proper rays of light for photosynthesis can't penetrate very far. So you're looking at really the first 10 metres of water where your seagrass will actually grow. So it's obviously very close to the coast, very close to where pollutants and everything else come out.
Exactly. And that's the reason why it's so vulnerable, really, to runoff from the land. And particularly if there's issues with the water quality, it means that the light can't get through to the leaves of the plant, and so it can't grow properly.
We have a seagrass in Dublin. In Malahide Estuary, there's one, Zostra augustifolia. There is said to be a clump of it on the Bull Island, but I have never seen it. Now, if you read about Brent geese, for instance, it's said that back in the 30s, 20s and 30s, there was ample Zostra around, and the geese feed on this. Why should it be such an enormous decline in a few decades? I mean, well, the pollution hasn't increased that much after all, and boats aren't tearing it apart. It seems an extraordinary collapse. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, I think governments haven't necessarily always been aware about the extent of the decline of seagrass. So I think it's an issue that's gone unnoticed for quite some time. I think people are starting to realise the importance now, and it's not too late to start protecting it. But we really need to act now to protect the seagrass that we have.
But presumably, if people inadvertently are damaging it, we would actually need to survey where it is, designate these areas as protected, so people with boats and that will have routes out and in, so that they're not willy-nilly going through unknown beds because they don't know they're there.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a combination of both, really. So we need to make sure that we protect the seagrass beds that we already have, and make sure that the government does this effectively. But also, if we're working to restore areas of seagrass beds, we need to make sure that those areas that are restored have the proper management in place to protect them.
Why should it be such a good carbon storage plant? I mean, where is the carbon actually going? I mean, there aren't massive tree trunks at the end or huge roots running through the, as there would be, say, in the rainforest or something like that. Where is this carbon going, and how does it come to be locked in the seabed?
Well, it's really interesting. So the seagrass, the blades of grass absorb the carbon dioxide from the water, and then they store this into the seagrass roots, but also the seabed sediments. So it's not actually just stored in the plant itself, it's actually going into the seabed. So this is a really different way of actually capturing carbon, and it can be really fast. So I think I mentioned earlier, it's about 35 times faster than the rate of a tropical forest. So it's a really important means of capturing large volumes of carbon.
So when the seagrass then dies, it being a plant, I mean, it hasn't got timber or anything in it, the actual plant itself might die, but the carbon stored in the sediments will last even if the grass is gone.
Exactly, and that's why it's a really important way of capturing carbon.
So, I mean, the areas where the seagrass was and no longer is, are the sediments still in the seabed underneath that, or have they gone too?
I guess that previously when those seagrass beds were in existence, they were capturing the carbon and that will still be stored. But in those areas where we no longer have the seagrass, or we have much less than we used to, we're not able to have that active carbon capturing still continuing. And that's what we really want to see restored, so that we can continue to have this function of capturing more carbon over time.
And will this alleviate the reduction of the Amazon rainforest, or are we comparing David and Goliath here? In fact, given that you can only have 0.2% of the seabed as suitable terrain for this, because it has to be in very shallow waters, I mean, is that area anything comparable to what a rainforest in the Amazon might hold?
Well, it's a pretty small area that is possible to do to restore seagrass, but the amount of carbon that it can capture is huge. So you can restore a fairly small area. So the kinds of areas we're looking at for this pilot project is only around 2 hectares. But that can capture a huge amount of carbon because of the rates, the high rates at which it can be stored by the seagrass. So we don't necessarily have to restore huge areas for the volume of carbon that can be captured. So the ocean's role in halting climate change is actually becoming much, much more important.
I think the important thing you're talking about here, Jenny, is this stability that one's restoring. Because if you think of a mobile sand beach, it's very unstable. It gets washed around and moved. If you have an existing seagrass bed, it mats it all together. The geese may be here browsing it in the winter, but in the summer, it's able to grow and develop all its rhizomes. The real problem for an eelgrass is it finds it incredibly difficult to establish a new stable bed. And your project of, you know, literally pinning down little seedlings in Hessian sacks will be, you know, a revelation to a method, a means by which we can restore Zostera seabeds here, because they will go quite deep underwater, but the point is they stabilize the sand and all of that carbon, the rhizomes, the whole ecosystem then becomes stabilized and it is resistant to being damaged by erosion.
Dr. Jenny Oates, UKC's Programme Manager with the WWF, thank you for joining us on Mooney Goes Wild. And that is our programme for today. My special thanks to Eanan Ilana, to Dr. Richard Collins, and to Matthew Jebb, the Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. Thanks to Sheila Neveal on sound, broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, the researcher John Riley, our producer is Sheila O'Callaghan. And the programme is back tomorrow evening at 10 o'clock. And indeed, Derek will be back with you as well next week too. From me, Michael Cummin, thanks for listening.